Wonders of the Night Sky You Must See Before You Die is the name of the new book by Bob King, better known among many of you who read the Duluth Tribune, News Tribune on a regular basis as Astro Bob. He's got a blog about what else? The Night Sky. It's a publication of Page Street Publishing, and Bob King joins us this morning here, or this afternoon. I always want to say this morning, and I'm stuck, man. You know, it's afternoon, Bob.
It's afternoon where I'm at, too, but it is morning somewhere. So, no problem.
Well, listen, thank you so much for joining us and enjoyed the book, and I've got a bunch of things I'd like to talk to you about. But your blog is all about night sky observation without a lot of observational equipment. And the same is largely the theme of this book. But you do start talking about Saturn, and I can understand why. And you kind of need a telescope for that. And I want you to know I did have a telescope many years ago, and I did take a look at Saturn. And you're right. Knocks you out.
Yeah, it really is. That's why I made it the first chapter.
That's what I thought.
First entry, yep.
Well, listen, let's talk a little bit about Saturn, but let's talk about what I need if I want to really get a pretty decent view of Saturn and some of the other planets and constellations and all without going into, you know, debt.
Into debt, right? That's always the thing. Mm-hmm. Well, I did, in the back of the book, there's a couple of pages of resources.
Yes.
And I went over and I tried to carefully select telescopes that provided enough firepower, I guess you could call it, and eyepieces and also binoculars, but that were not expensive. So nothing is pricey in terms of what I recommend for a telescope for things like Saturn. It's not that all the things in the book are like that. They're kind of a mix of binocular, naked eye, and telescope. So if you were looking to look at Saturn and get a good view, you could purchase something like a 4-inch or a 6-inch telescope for, I mean, you can see the rings of Saturn in a telescope that you might only pay $100 for, or perhaps even a little bit less. But, so that would be a minimum.
That was another revelatory thing for me when I set my scope up. And there were the rings of Saturn. Then I knew, I felt like a member of the universe by just seeing that thing. It's an amazing experience.
It is. It's just one of the most remarkable sights there is, because you look around, our experience on this planet is you never see anything like that.
Mm-mm.
When you look at it, the only time you see it is in photographs, right? So the most common reaction to seeing the planet Saturn in a telescope for the first time is it's not real. It looks like a photograph.
The other thing that I experienced the first time I looked through a telescope of any power was just how fast we're moving. I was focused on the moon, and I would have needed a motor to keep up with it. You know, I mean, those little hand cranks.
I was out with a group last night looking at Jupiter and a few other things in the sky. It had cleared off, and that was one of the things that most of the people remarked at was, especially when I moved up the magnification to about 150, it magnifies the Earth's rotation 150 times too. So any object kind of slowly moves from one end to the other of the field of view.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, you can get a telescope with a motor on it too. Otherwise, it's easy enough to just grab the end of the tube and give it a little push. Bring it back to the center.
Well, I wanted to set the stage for this because now we're going to talk about some individual things that you talk about in the book. And I'd like to start with planet conjunctions because, if I'm not mistaken, we either had one or are having one soon.
Yeah, they'll be coming up here pretty soon when the moon comes back into the evening sky when it's a crescent. Venus is hanging out there in the evening in the western sky all spring, all summer, and into the fall. So when the moon, every single time the moon comes back as a crescent, it's going to appear at some point not too far from the planet Venus, and the two will be in conjunction. So we've got some nice months ahead where we can see that kind of conjunction, that pairing up happening month after month. So lots of opportunities in case one night or another is cloudy.
Well, we, of course, our neighborhood is the Milky Way, and Well, what's the best way in your mind to get a sense of being there? Where in the sky should we look to get a feel for the Milky Way?
Oh, I love the Milky Way. I love how it makes me feel. You know, when you're underneath it on a summer night.
Yeah.
The best place, and of course, for listeners up the North Shore, there are some great opportunities because you can get away from city lights pretty easily. That's all you need, really, is to be outside of the city in a place where you can just lean back and look up. And the best time of the year, if you go out in the evening and want to view the Milky Way, is in the month of starting in about mid to late July all the way through the month of September. I would say August is like a primo month for Milky Way viewing. Make sure when you do go out that the moon is not up. If there's a full moon or even a half moon out, that's probably not the best time. But if it's a crescent or if it's moonless, that's the night. I mean, to stand under that is our galaxy and the sense of enormity and kind of how you feel. You know, it really puts things into perspective on those August evenings.
And then it brings you down to earth when you have to slap the mosquitoes when you're standing out there in July or August.
True. Well, maybe then you want to wait until September. A little bit better of a month. But if you want to see the Milky Way now, there's nothing stopping it.
Yeah.
It's in the morning sky, so you would go up, but not many people will do this. You would be up at 3 or 4 o'clock before twilight begins in the morning, and then you can see it then, too. You get kind of a sneak peek of what's coming for the summer if you get up in the dawn hours.
Mm-hmm. Well, of course, the Milky Way's galaxy. And galaxies and large star systems, let's talk about those, because Andromeda is another one you can see, and Orion and the Pleiades.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about those and anything else that we can just kind of look up and see. Sometimes it's just a little smudge, but without any additional equipment, but still, they're there. I mean,
they're there, I know. And with astronomy, with observing, you kind of bring it. If you have a little bit of knowledge, and that's what this book provides, some basic information about these things, so that even if it does look like a smudge, you know kind of what's behind it, you know, the same way that you might appreciate a painting by knowing a little bit about the artist or the history. So, yes, the constellation Orion, I think, I don't know how many people have told me that's one of their favorites, but it's one of mine, too. But that's kind of on its way out. It's basically gone now that we're in the month of May, and it will return again in the morning sky in late August, so it'll be up at dawn. And that's kind of one of the fun things I like to do, is sort of welcome Orion back early at the end of summer. And you mentioned the Pleiades, that star cluster. That is just still visible. Well, now it's getting pretty low in the west now, actually. Venus was in conjunction with the Pleiades a couple of weeks ago, but now the Pleiades has moved westward. And then the Andromeda galaxy is one other galaxy that most of us can see in the constellation Andromeda. But to see that, you need to be out in late summer, fall, and winter. Right now is not a great time for Andromeda.
No, but when you address each of these topics in the book, we've got the time frames, and you know, so you're not roaming around looking for something at the wrong time of the year.
Yeah, exactly. We're trying to focus it to pick the best time, and since it's all of the different things to look at are visible through different seasons, there's always something that you can look at.
Well, it's back to that Earth movement thing. we don't stay in the same place, so you gotta keep track of it. But you mentioned constellations, and some of the ones that we see pretty easily. So talk about dippers, bears, lions, and hunters.
Yeah, well, the Big Dipper is the one. I'll tell you, this is the time of the year to see the Big Dipper, spring and summer, because it's right overhead right now. And it's part of a larger group of stars. If you connect all these little faint stars around it, you can make out the figure of the Great Bear, Ursa Major. Mm-hmm. And then, kind of interesting, most of the stars of the Dipper, there are 7 of them, right?
Yeah.
If you remove the star at the end of the handle and the one at the end of the bucket, those remaining stars are the center of a star cluster. Those stars are all related. They were born together.
Oh.
And that has kind of a fancy name. It's in the book, too. It's called the Ursa Major Moving Cluster. So you can look at. There's like 3 ways to look at it. You can see the Big Dipper, you can see the Great
Well, one of the things that people get excited about are eclipses, and you talk about both sun and moon eclipses. If I were somewhere else in the universe, would I see eclipses?
Yes, you would. You wouldn't have to go too far. You could go to Jupiter and see an eclipse of the sun. You'd have to be orbiting the planet and then get yourself under one of the shadows of one of Jupiter's moons, just the way you're underneath the moon's shadow on the Earth in order to see an eclipse. If you were at the right distance beneath that moon orbiting Jupiter, you would see, we'll name the moon. You'd see the moon Io or Ganymede. You'd see it eclipse the sun.
Huh.
So, yeah, you can have it. And the Martian moons also eclipse the sun, but they're too small to cover it completely, so they make partial eclipses. So you could go to Mars, too. But you wouldn't get the beautiful total eclipse like we get here on Earth.
Oh, because it's smaller. Yeah, okay.
It's smaller. Yeah, our moon's the right size for regular total solar eclipses. We'll have another one in at least over the United States so we can drive to it, just like last year.
Yep.
We'll have another one in April of 2024.
Okay. And I should let our listeners know that these key dates and times and places are listed. So, you know, it's not a book you want to put on the shelf. It's one you want to keep out.
That sounds good. I would agree.
I know you would. You're right. Okay, now, one of the things that we, of course, glory in up here on the North Shore, as you do in the Duluth area, auroras. We've been really fortunate this year to have some pretty spectacular nighttime displays. So
yeah.
Talk a little bit about what they are and especially some of the coloration. Most of the time, you know, I grew up thinking aurora was the color of, you know, green phosphorus, but some of it is very colorful. What causes that, Bob?
Well, here's just to draw a distinction. There's the aurora seen through a camera lens and a time exposure, and the aurora that we see with our eyes.
Uh-huh.
And the camera version, because it can record many seconds of time, it can accumulate light, the colors that it produces are much more vivid than what you see with your eye. So a lot of people, including myself, will post pictures of the aurora, and someone will look at that and they say, well, gee, I went out, it didn't look like that. And that's understandable because it was taken with a camera. With your eye, which sees things instantaneously, the aurora can still be colorful. Normally, usually the brightest parts are kind of a pale green, the way you describe it, Jay. And then if it really gets intense, there are times when the aurora gets very red, almost the same color as the red in a stop sign.
Mm.
So that's a little uncommon, but it does happen. And the colors are caused by when the particles that are coming from the sun work their way down, moving very, very fast. They get down into our atmosphere about 60, 80 miles over our head. They strike the atoms and molecules there, and they kind of give them energy. They hit them very hard, and it cranks up their energy. And as those atoms and molecules relax back to how they were just moments before, they release that energy in the form of light. And that light comes out as, depending on the atom, comes out as red. It might come out as green. And there's other colors, too. But red and green are the most common. And those colors come from oxygen and also from nitrogen. So those are the two most common types of atoms in the atmosphere. That's what we breathe.
Now, if I want to capture some of this on a camera, what do I need? What kind of equipment do I need to do that?
Well, you need, I actually was just looking at a cell phone that can now do this, but the cell phone costs $1,000.
Oh, well, that's...
I don't think you need that. But what you need is a camera that is, I would recommend a digital SLR camera, somewhere in the price range of around $400 to $500, in that range. And whatever camera you get, it has to be able to take a time exposure.
Right.
You'll want to be able to, you know, do a 15-second absolute minimum with a kind of a lower or middle-end camera, preferably 30 seconds. And then open your lens up all the way so you get that maximum amount of light coming through that lens so you can take as short an exposure as possible. So what I usually do, and you know what, Jay, we did it last night. We had a little bit of northern light last night. So I put my camera on a tripod, opened up that lens, and I exposed for 30 seconds at ISO 1600. And that's your, you know, sensitivity of your sensor. You can set it up for 400, 800. These are all little settings that are on your camera. So go to 1600, do a 30-second exposure, take a look at the back of the camera, and you may just be surprised you have your first picture of the aurora.
Well, good.
Do you have that kind of a camera where you can do a time?
Yeah,
exposure?
I do, as a matter of fact, yeah. I'm just going to follow your instructions right now.
If I could just add one more thing, a lot of cameras like that have something called live view, where you can press a button on the back, and it shows you the live view on the back screen.
Yeah.
So you move the camera around. That's what you use to focus, because that's a key part of taking a picture of the night sky. You have to focus that camera lens on the stars, because otherwise the camera will just keep seeking. It can't focus at night. So you have to put your lens on manual,
right,
and then use live view, and then just hand focus the lens until the stars are sharp pinpoint.
Okay.
Then you're good for the night.
Good. That sounds great. Well, speaking of phenomena like you also talk about moon dogs and sun dogs. And I've seen sun dogs, but I don't know that I've seen moon dogs.
Well, I hear a lot of dogs barking at night in my neighborhood, but very few of them are moon dogs.
Okay, Bob.
Moon dogs, I'm sorry. Please forgive me. But moon dogs are not as common as sun dogs. Sun dogs are a little easier to see because the sun's so bright.
Right, yeah.
Okay, so the moon, not so bright, so they're not as obvious, and they don't happen as often. But when they do, they kind of look like earmuffs. You know, the old earmuffs, like puffs on either end of a halo around the moon. So if you see a bright halo around the moon, you kind of keep an eye on it, because you might see those bright patches of light that form on either side of the moon inside or on the halo. Those are moon dogs.
Any particular sky conditions for that, or weather conditions?
Well, it helps to have a full moon, you know, to have a bright moon to begin with. And then the sky conditions would be like a warm front moving in, you know, where the clouds are gradually, they start high and they gradually get lower. And so you have a cirrus, kind of a feathery kind of cloud. And the main thing is, though, is the easiest part is just if there's a halo around the moon, keep an eye on it, and you might see a moon dog.
Oh, okay.
They usually come together. You usually get halos and moon dogs together.
Okay. Well, the other thing that is, of course, popular with most people that do any sky looking, meteor showers, comets, asteroids. You talk quite a bit about all of those.
Yeah, there's a great asteroid. As a matter of fact, it's just starting to kind of make an appearance this month, but from now into, I think, early August, I have a map in the book on how to find the asteroid Vesta.
Mm-hmm.
And Vesta is, of all of the asteroids, the brightest one. And from Grand Marais area, if you get to a dark sky, you'll actually be able to see this without binoculars at all.
Really?
When it's at its brightest. It'll be a little faint star up there, but it's really unusual to see an asteroid with just your naked eye. So that'll be this spring and early summer. And then you mentioned, what were the other things? There was asteroids.
Comets. Yep. And meteor showers.
There's going to be kind of a brighter comet later this year in December called Comet Wirtanen, and I provide a map for that in the book, too.
And meteor showers, we see a lot of those.
Yeah, it's a fantastic year for meteor showers.
Yep.
The reason is we don't have any bright moon during the best showers.
Ah.
The best one, and that's what makes the difference. You get a full moon and a meteor shower, and moonlight wipes them out. But in August, when we have the Perseid shower, no moon, no problem. So we're going to see like the maximum number. And then in December, there'll also be no moon, and that's when you get the strongest meteor shower of the year on about December 13th, called the Geminids.
Oh, yeah. Now, before I let you go, we only got a couple of minutes left here, but speaking of things that are moving like that in the sky, let's talk about viewing satellites, the space station, and where's Tesla?
Where's Tesla right now? You mean the car?
Yeah.
Oh, man. I don't know. That guy's still driving it up there through space. It's on its orbit. It's just heading away. It continues to head away from the Earth.
Mm-hmm.
On its orbit, I know it's going to pass sort of out to roughly Mars distance, and then it'll swing back towards the sun, and it's going to be out there for millions of years. I wish it were big enough and bright enough where you could point a telescope at it and see it, but it isn't. It's very, very faint.
Okay. But you can see the space station, and we see satellites zipping across the sky all the time.
I know. There's lots and lots of them. A lot of those satellites, some are working actual satellites, and others are just rocket stages that went up for the ride that put the thing into orbit. There are a lot of rocket stages from Russian satellites up there that we see. But I'm glad you asked about it because the International Space Station will be making passes over our region again starting about May 21st in the evening sky. So May 21st through about June 8th, if you see a very bright object in the western sky appearing, you know, that's moved eastward, that's the International Space Station. It's almost as bright as Venus when it's at its best.
And it's moving pretty good.
Yeah, it takes only about 5 minutes or so to go from west to east. So, yeah, it's steady and just keeps going. And then it comes around again about an hour and a half later. So we're going to be able to see multiple passes of the space station late May through early June, all through the night.
Great. That information also appears in Wonders of the Night Sky, You Must See Before You Die. And we've been speaking with its author, Bob King. Bob's blog and columns in the Duluth News Tribune called Astro Bob. Lots of fun things to check in with. This has been a fun book to read and a fun book to keep around because I'm kind of an astronomy nut.
But, I can tell. You've been watching the sky. That's wonderful.
Well, my wife's one of these people that knows where all this stuff is, you know, so I just, you know, she says, over there, so I look. So together we're going to continue to enjoy this. And it's been great fun talking with you. We've been speaking with Bob King. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.